All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show, and that's Outer National with Decisions. And you know that because we play it every week, but it's still a song that just drives me nuts, man. I really love that song. And it says a lot about what we're facing in the world today and the need for everybody to make decisions and know the kinds of decisions that you need to make. You know, and that's what today's show, we're going to be spending a lot of time talking about that, okay? At the back end of the show, we're going to hear a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's from a talk he gave in 2017, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible." Now, he's talking about building a sustained, nonviolent mass movement of millions to stay in the streets and drive out the fascist Trump-Pence regime. And he's responding to a question, how can we sustain the massive movement required to drive this regime from power? In the crisis brought about by the fascist massacre in El Paso just days ago, this is an even more urgent question. We don't have a lot of time. Before that, we'll hear a speech by Noche Diaz of the Revolution Club. And Noche is part of the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. The tour is in Chicago, and Noche is speaking at a commemoration of Red Summer. And opening the show up, I'm going to be talking to the author of a very important book, a very good book on a topic of very great importance. It's How Fascism Works, a book called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, and it's by Jason Stanley. And Jason is our guest, our opening guest today. Jason, how are you?
As well as I can be, given the political situation, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So, Jason, let's jump into this, man, because I agree. It's what we're talking about today in terms of what's going on is unparalleled. And I think it's really something that too many people, I think, are still not very woke up. You know, they're kind of, you know, going with the flow. And then, okay, well, it's just, I'm listening to the radio when I'm driving in. People need to actually dig into what's happening. So, and I know you have been doing this. You started this way back with this book, you know, and before that. But you said that this country is facing an emergency after what's been branded by one of the single most racist moments in American history, which was just a little while ago. You talked about we're in an emergency situation now. What makes you go from, you know, the analysis that you had out there about fascism and all this other stuff that was, you know, very good and very strong, but you go into that and you're saying that we're in an emergency situation. What are we talking about here?
So How Fascism Works, the book, is about the kinds of politics that Donald Trump has brought to our country. Those kinds of politics are not new. They've been in our country before, but we've never had a president elected on those politics in modern times. What we have now, and the reason we have an emergency, is we have those politics moving into policy. We always had to ask ourselves, when would this vicious attack on Muslims, when would the vicious attack on immigrants go into policies, go into action? For a long time, it was rhetoric, and that was the same as you find in the history of other regimes. Like in the 1930s in Germany, people would say, well, the things about the Jews, Hitler's just doing that to win elections. He's not serious. So, you know, right now, we have a moment where we have a chance to regain our democracy. We don't need to experiment with how long is this going to go on, when will it move into action. We're already seeing it move into action. We're seeing the Republican Party become a fascist party. We're seeing them back the president come what may. We're seeing the Congress become irrelevant. We're seeing executive power. I mean, Trump is not the first to do this. It's a bunch of presidents who enabled him, including Obama, but we're seeing executive power take over. And we're seeing this all in the service of a vicious ethno-nationalist, white supremacist, racist, anti-immigrant agenda, which we have had before in our country, but a long time ago. World War II was something that weaned us of this kind of politics because we were the country that fought against it. But right now, when you see those rallies, I mean, if you look at How Fascism Works, where I trace the National Socialist politics, Italian fascist politics, and you look at the chapter titles, like chapter 9 is called Sodom and Gomorrah. It's about how the cities are places, are always like places that are filled with crime and foreigners and out of control and need to be tamed by the strong leader. That's straightforwardly the kind of politics we're seeing right now.
You know, one of the things that got me too, though, is that when we were talking about this, I was, you know, you wrote somewhere about it was about basically there was a certain thing that you were putting out that was like, okay, it started now, but it's not that. And, you know, as you looked at it, I remember when the book came out, this was actually the situation was not that fascism is being established. The situation was, look, watch out, because this is what's being, you know, kicked around. But now we're talking about, actually, there is a fascist in the White House. There's all these the unleashing of all these fascists in the, you know, at these massive rallies. I mean, these things that are happening that actually dictate something completely different than I think what has been, you know, not just expected or what's been done there over the years, but there actually is something that's, even though we know some of this happened in the past, but there's much more. It seems much heavier now.
Right. When I wrote the book, I was calling attention to the fact that the rhetoric and politics and ideology we were seeing, this ideology of like hysteria about lax immigration laws, the definition of the nation as in peril from immigrants, the loss of our culture, when you have to ask what does our culture mean there, you know, all of that is toxic, is fascism, is I mean, there's a long sort of how fascism works has 10 chapters. There's other elements, but we see all of those elements, the mythic past, this invention of a past, a great past, where there was just one, where we reigned, quote-unquote, we reigned supreme. So it was rhetoric at that point. And it was unclear to me how much President Trump was going to push forward that rhetoric into policy. Now, what we've seen all these check marks, like appoint lackeys into government positions who will do what he say. We're seeing the erosion of our democratic institutions. We're seeing it happen at an alarmingly rapid pace. Now, we have states and that have power, so California stands up to some extent against Trump. So we have this institutional structure that protects us to some extent against this, but we are starting to see with the open, naked cruelty on the southern border. The border's always been a place of cruelty, but we're seeing it institutionalized. We're seeing that kind of cruelty institutionalized. In the 1930s, the Nazis used concentration camps not as death camps. Those came later in like 1941. You know, we're talking years after Hitler's ascension to power. But in the 1930s, the Nazis used concentration camps as a means to get people to self-deport. They'd arrest, after the pogrom of November 9th and 10th, 1938, they arrested 30,000 Jewish men, put them in Dachau, Sachsenhausen, other concentration camps. They were tortured and then released. That was to get them to self-deport. Well, we have that exact same strategy being used against longtime residents of the United States. And we have a cruelty being baked into our political culture as definitive of what it means to be an American. And that is not who we are. That's not who we are historically. That's not who we are. I mean, okay, partly it's we have a war with who we are historically. But it goes back to the ugliest parts of America. And, you know, we fought against those ugly parts, and we're going to need to do it again.
You know, one of the things that you bring out in your book, and you were just alluding to this now, what's happening with immigrants as a vital part of how they're establishing, bringing on fascism? I think it's really important to dig into that a little bit and let people know, what is the situation with immigrants and in relation to this development of fascism?
So if you read Mein Kampf, Hitler again and again goes on about Germany's lax immigration laws. What are the 1935 Nuremberg laws? 1935 Nuremberg laws, well, they banned marriage between German Jews and Germans who weren't Jewish, but principally they removed citizenship from German Jews, and then they removed citizenship from all those who weren't of German or kindred blood. We're seeing that complete, and Hitler in Mein Kampf repeatedly rants and raves about lax immigration laws. So that's, you know, Oswald Mosley. Now, the Nazis are a particularly extreme example. I usually say that there's no comparing what's happening now with National Socialism in terms of the events. We're not having like a full takeover. We're having things moving in processes. But as far as the ideology here, the British Fascist Party, Oswald Mosley, his motto was Britain for the British. He called for zero immigration. Well, in 2020, the Trump administration is calling for zero refugees. And this is in the United States of America. So immigration, this idea, the structuring of fascism, fascist ideology defines the nation via a foreign threat. And the idea is the foreign threat is a threat to, quote-unquote, our culture. So instead of having a positive identification of the nation is under threat. Our culture is under threat from these outsiders who are going to overrun us. And the focus is always on immigration laws. And often you pick a religious minority. In the Nazis, it was the Jews. Right now, in the United States, it's the Muslims. And there's a very familiar structure directed against them. So according to the Nazis, the Jews weren't really German. Their loyalty was to other Jews, not to fellow Germans. They couldn't really be German. They were a fifth column, and their real goal was to bring socialism and communism to Germany. Well, what is being said about Muslim Americans, with Ilhan Omar being sort of a standard bearer? They're not real Americans. Their loyalty is to other Muslims, and they're trying to bring socialism and communism to America. So what disturbs me is the very similar structure with Jews being swapped out for Muslims.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things that actually, to me, it's sort of one of the things that's happened with this, and again, going back to immigrants, going back to and taking up with Muslims, you know, the fact that people, that this is actually, what's happening with them is they're shut off from the outside world once they're in the hands of the system. And that reminds me of, and you reference this in your book a lot, in a lot of places, about what happened to Jewish people or gypsies or people that were swept up by the Nazis, thrown into these camps, and basically they disappeared. And this seems to be something that's happening more and more here, where people are disappearing into these cyclone-fenced, you know, concentration camps, basically.
Right. Well, so people have to realize that journalists are not allowed into these camps. So the only people that are allowed into these camps are legal representatives and, with a two-week notice, members of Congress. So who can tell us what's going on inside these camps? Well, for a member of Congress visit, you know they're going to clean up their act. So it's particularly dramatic when AOC goes in and sees non-functioning sinks and such like, because they have 2 weeks to prepare. But legal representation, that's basically our window into these camps. And the government has said that the money to represent migrant children, juveniles, has run out. And that means that legal representation will not be provided for them. Legal representation can't go into the camps. So step by step, we're getting the few insights we have into these camps being blocked from us. And what little we see suggests a kind of regularization and normalization of torture and horror. I mean, as the administration themselves says, the point of these camps is deterrence to get people to self-deport. So we don't know what's going on in these camps. It does look, the parallels to 1930s Germany, obviously not death camps, but the parallels to what was happening in the 1930s when political dissidents, Jews, Roma, and others were put into, and minor criminals were put into concentration camps and tortured and beaten, but not usually murdered. The parallels are there. They're very stark for those of us who are historians of that era.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to move on to something else here too, because you've talked about this idea of the reality of the modern day Nuremberg rally. And to me, that's something that people, I still don't think people get it. They say, oh, well, this is a, you know, they might get a little bit shocked, but not that much, because it's like, oh, we've always had these, you know, politicians go out, they whip up their crowds, they do this and all this. But the content of what Trump is doing, I thought that the fact that you raised this as the modern day Nuremberg rally and the culture of a real America, I think it's important to dig into right now.
Yes, the rallies, I think, are fascist rallies. I mean, when you look at Hitler's description of propaganda, slogans, he says the best propaganda takes the form of slogans, small slogans that you can chant and repeat. Now, some scholars of fascism, like Robert Paxton, will say, to make a distinction between the Nuremberg rallies and what we're seeing, well, in the Nuremberg rally, people were wearing uniforms, whereas they were chanting, very similar chanting, but they were wearing uniforms. But, you know, my response to that is that's not American culture. That might be German culture to have rallies that way, because there's a sort of Prussian, you know, fascism always melds itself with the culture of the country and can fascism will look very different in Italy than it looks in Germany because the cultures are different. Our fascist rallies are going to take place with people in, you know, MAGA hats and horrifically racist T-shirts doing 2 minutes of hate. And we're seeing that. We're seeing the chanting, the rallying, the leader whipping up fear, whipping up panic about the loss of the culture to foreigners, you know, tarring political opponents as enemies of the state and mortal threats and raising this fear and then promising to deliver them. And in that moment of ecstasy, you have just hatred against the enemy bursting forth in slogans. And this is what history tells us. If you read Viktor Klemperer on Nazi rallies, I mean, or Wilhelm Reich, this is their description. And that's what we're seeing. It's American culture. It's not German culture. And American fascism is going to look different than German fascism. But these are moments where people's worst instincts are allowed to bond together and come free. And so, you know, the anti-Muslim sentiment that has been reported at, in today's Atlantic article about the Cincinnati rally, I mean, you know, you just have to shift your mind and think, well, what would it look like if the people that were targeted were Muslims instead of Jews?
Yeah, exactly. You know, this thing about American exceptionalism is something that I think is really highly operative here in terms of, well, it can't happen here, but it is happening here. And like you said, you know, you looked at it and you thought first, you know, there was a difference, I think, at just the beginning in something you wrote in early July and then what you were writing more recently at the end of July. And you're saying, wait a minute, this is, you know, here I said this in early July and it was true. But now look at where we're at. There's actually this thing about the consolidation or the moves to consolidate fascism, everything from packing the courts to all these other things that are going on. And this is something that you said you're not easily shocked, but this is a whole different ballgame. This is the face of evil and we're in an emergency. Let's talk about that.
Well, Trump has appointed one out of every four federal appellate judges. These are people in their 30s and 40s. They're largely white men. They're going to be in there for decades to come. He's packing the courts. When I talk to my legal, my friends in law schools, they say that these are partisan, extreme partisan judges. So we have court packing like in Poland, like in Hungary. That's happening. We've got voter suppression all over the country. The red states are casting off ballots at alarmingly high rates. Like, you know, it looks like states like California, when they look at their voter rolls, you know, they're only casting off some like 1-2% or 1-3% of voters for not being able to find housing addresses. But in states like Indiana, it's much higher. I think it can be as high as 20%. That study came out today or yesterday. So we've got extreme voter suppression. We have to remember this president lost by 2.9 million votes. So, and we've got this justification of a minority-ruled country, a country ruled by the minority of voters. So, you know, democracy doesn't mean acreage of land. It means one person, one vote. And we're seeing that deeply under threat. The Supreme Court legitimated partisan gerrymandering. So, you know, we have states where, you know, 49% of people vote for Democrats, and we've got, you know, 66 or 63% Republican representation in the state legislatures. We have even worse in some states like North Carolina. I think in North Carolina it was like bare majority voted for Democrats for Congress, but there's many more Republican Congress people. So we have to ask ourselves, in what sense are we a democracy? Our system already structurally was set up to put us in this situation, but with the court packing, with the voter suppression, with the gerrymandering, we're in an extreme situation. And the oligarchs are now seeing, as they did in the 1930s in Germany, that they can get stuff done through this, that democracy maybe isn't in their best interests. I mean, you know, it's not really always clear how democracy and capitalism would get along. But at some point, you know, oligarchs are going to say, as we're seeing in Brazil right now with the destruction of the Amazon and Bolsonaro, oligarchs are going to say, well, hey, this democracy thing is a much more indirect route to getting the stuff done we want done. So we're in the Republican Party shows utterly no interest in democracy. Hannah Arendt talks about the risk of people who exhibit loyalty to party over parties, and that's what we're seeing in the Republican Party. As far as I can tell, the vast majority of the Republican Party is all about power. They don't care about democracy at all. It's all about retaining power. So at that point, we have to ask, who here is going to be there for democracy? I mean, I'm going to be there to protect the voice of conservatives, to protect the voice of those with whom I disagree. But when I see the opposing party, when I see, if you look at the way Trump talks about Democrats, he doesn't talk about them as his citizens. They're not his citizens. His citizens are his supporters. And that bond you're seeing between Trump and his supporters, that's an authoritarian bond that he's creating and has been creating. And that's what the rallies are about. It's about, it's us, and it's a war of us versus them, and we've got control, and we're not going to let them participate at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have to wrap this up real fast, but I did have one final question for you, and maybe we can just, you know, narrow it down to its essence. You've said that all humans are equally deserving of value and what that demands. I think that's a really important comment in the world today. And you said this not just in general, but especially today, and especially in terms of journalists and what they do in the face of all this. And I think it's journalists and especially, but also anyone who's awake, needs to actually understand what they're being called on to do today. Let's talk about that real quick.
Journalists are the backbone, and that's why it's so... when people talk about the media, mainstream media being taken over by leftists, well, Sinclair Broadcasting owns a huge percentage of television, of television stations. They're far right. Fox News. We have propaganda stations, just giving you a complete party line right now. And they are some of the most powerful media conglomerates in the country. And so what we need are independent voices, independent journalists, independent radio stations delivering critical voices against a tide of corporate money.
And I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Jason.
Thank
it's really,
so
really good to talk with you. And I'm sure I'll be talking with you again in the near future.
Excellent.
All right.
Thank
take
you,
care
Michael,
now, man.
For the work you do.
Sure.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And as you heard, he's someone who's ringing the bell, calling everybody to come out onto the commons and make your face seen, your thoughts heard, and stand up against this. I want you to hear something right now that's just a short little piece, and I think because I think it says something about what we've just been talking about. It's called Order or Justice, and it's by Bob Avakian from the film The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. We need to hear this, sisters and brothers, and then we need to act in relation to that. All right, so check this out, and we'll be right back.
It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice. While for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals, and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program.
All right, that was Bob Avakian with a piece called Order or Justice, and it's from the film The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. We're going to take a musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Alright, that was Not in Our Name by Savage Rose. Now let's hear Noche Diaz of the Revolution Club and the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour speaking in Chicago at a commemoration of Red Summer.
Look behind us. Look into these waters. Think about where you stand. Think about the fact that 100 years ago, a teenager lost his life drowning in these waters because he was born in this world of lines, imaginary lines that divide up humanity, a whites-only line in a lake. What kind of world is this? This is not human nature. This is not just the way things have to be. This is the way things have been made because of this system. Because this country was founded with white supremacy woven into every fabric, every institution, and in the minds of the people of the United States. Look at these waters. Now, I'm not a religious man, but if you can't feel the spirit, if you can't feel 100 years of history in this space, it is just because you have grown up in this world, where your humanity has been conditioned out of you. Including white people not even learning about this history and learning to find their own humanity and connecting with what this country and what this system has done to oppress people throughout its history. And as you're standing, I want you all to raise a fist. And I want you all to join me in saying, no more.
No more.
No more.
No more.
No more.
No more.
Now I'm going to talk a little bit about what it's going to take to make it real, to make no more a reality. So we're not here generations from now commemorating more ugly history. Now, first of all, you heard Carl Dix break down some of this history before, but I do want to say it, and it has to be said. The rocks that flew at Eugene Williams and at the black beachgoers who tried to save his life, those rocks did not just fly one way that week of the Red Summer here in Chicago, okay? People actually defended themselves, and that is buried and covered over too. And it's not just that we need to know that history, we need to draw a lesson and inspiration from that history. God damn, we need a revolution to put an end to this, but why can't people be fighting back today in the determination that people showed 100 years ago to stop this? In a day and an age when black and brown bodies litter the streets because they're gunned down by murderous police, it is a national fucking emergency when some youth in New York throw some water at these pigs. A national emergency that 27 black so-called community leaders feel compelled to condemn in a joint statement. But no such joint statement and condemnation is made against the murdering thugs in the police departments across this country who carry out terror, murder, and brutality against these youth. And the courage that was shown by the people 100 years ago in standing up to that violence, by defending themselves, including by taking to arms to defend people, was righteous. It was not just part of the woeful violence that took place 100 years ago. It was part of a different legacy. A legacy of people standing up and resisting their oppression. A legacy that has taught us many great lessons, including the biggest lesson, which is that all the heroic struggle and sacrifice in the world will, in the end, mean nothing and come to nothing if we do not have the leadership that we need to get at the system that has caused all this. If we do not get ready for a time when we can really put an end to this, we will be fighting the same damn thing generation and generation from now. So as you stand here and you take in what it means to be at this historic site, the world of lines that spelled death for Eugene Williams, down to today with the world of lines that spelled death for children crossing the border at the U.S.-Mexico imaginary line that was drawn out there. Or the lines, the imaginary lines that are drawn in the inner cities where the very youth who are oppressed and cast into these conditions are set up to fight and kill each other off for crossing imaginary lines, for set tripping, because they're divided up fighting each other. Or the lines between the north side and the south side of Chicago, where if black teenagers are found in the loop at the wrong time and there's too many of them, they're rounded up and put on one-way trains back to the south side to go back to where they came from. The same way this fascist in the White House has attacked those Congress people, go back to where you came from. The same taunts that were shouted at the black beachgoers who tried to save the life of Eugene Williams, go back to the colored side of the beach where you came from. This is the line that connects 100 years ago to today. A line which we can't just remember and mark. A line that has to be broken, sisters and brothers. A world that needs to be completely gone with all of its imaginary lines that divide people up. A world that needs to be brought down through revolution, nothing less. But we have some work to do, because it's not enough to be out here today and be part of commemorating this history and hearing some good things. You know, we've been going out, and you might hear some more today. We've been going out to not only spread the word about the fact that we have this leadership and strategy for revolution, that there's this guy, Bob Avakian, who's been spending decades actually going to work on how we could actually make this no more. But we've actually been involving people in working on the big obstacles and the big problems of the revolution, including the fact that you have this open white supremacy in office, preparing for a new civil war. And where the hell are the people who need to be in the streets day after day? And what do we do about that? And a lot of people have told us that there's a lot of fear paralyzing people. And I want to say a couple things about this. And I also want to invite people here to be part of working on this with us, because we have to break down and transform this fear. But I do want to say something. You look at the picture, either on this banner or the picture on this panel of 1919, of these police and National Guard surrounding black people with rifles. Don't tell me there was no fear back then. Don't tell me there was no fear when people decided that enough was enough and they weren't gonna just live with this. I feel there's not enough fear these days. Not just fear of what might happen to us if we stand up, but what will happen to humanity if we don't. Not enough fear of allowing another generation to come up under this same nightmare, this same world of lines. Not enough fear of having to look the next generation in the eye and tell them what we did when an open white supremacist was in the White House fomenting this new civil war. Not enough fear of what is happening to our planet being destroyed right from under us, to a point where human life might not even be able to survive for much longer if we allow this system to go on. There's not enough fear of what might happen to humanity and the planet. Too much fear of for self. And we have to change that. And it's not a mystery. It's not all a mystery. There's some things we have to solve together. We don't have all the answers, but some things are not a mystery. When everything seems dark, it can be scary and there can be fear. But when you see a way through, when you see some light at the end of the tunnel, it gives you not just hope, but courage and daring. This is what we have. This is what we are spreading around the country with this National Revolution Tour. Real hope and a basis to find our courage and our daring. It's, again, not a mystery. All it is that Bob Avakian has done some work to identify where all this comes from, to identify where the pathways are, to changing things, to building up the forces, to waging a political war now, all out, to prepare for a time when we can really wage a revolutionary war to bring this system down. That is the light at the end of the tunnel. That is the hope, which should give us hope and daring and a way to find our courage and our determination to come together and solve all the obstacles and all the problems in the way, including, look, all the people we interacted with here today. A lot of people were shocked to hear about some of this history, encouraged to hear that there are some people marking it and talking about doing something about it. But the fact is, many people are not crossing that line in front of them. That comfort zone, that line that we need to be part of fighting for many more people to cross, and we don't need everybody right now. What we need is people like you who are here to become part of those who are saying, I'm gonna be the first. I don't give a damn what everyone else is gonna do. I am finding my courage right here today, together with others, to go up against every obstacle and to bring forward more people. And think about this. If you had even a few dozen people here in Chicago, together with the dozens in LA who came forward through the course of the tour there, together with people in other parts of the country who are learning about and hearing about what this revolution is doing to organize forces. If you had those dozens becoming scores, becoming hundreds right now, as an organized force, not just a bunch of woke folk tweeting and retweeting. Although, don't get me wrong, people need to be active on social media spreading the word about the revolution, but that needs to be manifest in real life, like we are doing here today. Now imagine there were hundreds of people around the country doing that, and what that would mean for those who look around and say, I'm not doing anything because no one else is doing anything. That could be part of puncturing all of that belief that this is just the way things are and always will be and always can be. When they see other people who are willing to be the first and step out and say, we are going for the whole thing. And those hundreds can then begin to turn and influence thousands and millions and build up an organized force of thousands who can then further impact things and realign society and get things closer to a revolution. And let's break down what that means, sisters and brothers, because what we are commemorating here today, that red summer, that cannot be what a revolution looks like. Where black people are surrounded and encircled by racist lynch mobs who are just determined to gun them down and kill them off. The revolution we are working for has to bring together white people, black people, Latino people, Asian people, women, men, differently gendered people, young, old. And that has to represent the thousands and ultimately millions who actually can be an organized force that could go up against and defeat this powerful enemy we are up against and bring it down. That is what we need to set ourselves to. The blueprint, the battle plan for that has been laid out by Bob Avakian. We're going to be watching the film, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Could Really Make Revolution, this Monday, where he elaborates and breaks down the strategy and the battle plan for revolution. He talks about why this system can't be reformed, but also how it could be overthrown, how we need to work today to prepare for that kind of a revolution. I invite everybody to come out this Monday, but more than that, I invite everybody. I don't know what you're doing with your summer, but it's not more important than running with the revolution tour for the next 4 weeks while we are in town to turn this situation around. Spend the next 4 weeks of your summer doing everything you can to contribute whatever you can to making a real advance in the movement for revolution here. To leave behind organization of dozens who are working together to build up and to the scores and the hundreds together with people throughout the country and ultimately thousands over the course of the next year. Whatever you're doing this summer, find your way in, whether it's by helping raise funds for the revolution tour, whether it's by bringing people together to meet folks who are on this revolution tour and to discuss how they can be part of this revolution. Or whether it's coming out and learning and drilling with us, learning how to march, learning how to project, going out to the masses of people to bring them forward into the revolution and to work on how we fight the power and transform people today to prepare for revolution. Because as I said a little bit earlier, we are on a mission to get to a world without all this, to really say no more. We are waging a political war now to break down the encirclement of people, to break down the divisions amongst different sections of the people, to build up the organized forces of this revolution, to train new leaders of this revolution who are taking up the new communism and the science that Bob Avakian has been developed so that they can be part of leading the millions when the time comes for an all-out fight to bring this system down, and we have a strategy for how people can fight in that situation to win. And then we have a constitution that Avakian has written. A constitution for a new socialist republic that would be working not just to break down the lines here in this country, but to be part of a world revolution to get all of humanity free from this nightmare. A constitution for a new socialist republic, which will be established after the revolution in the territory of what we must make the former United States. So I invite you to think about that. Getting to a world without America, establishing a new society on the ashes of this rotten old empire. Think about that as we lift up these stones and drop it on that American flag. Think about the Eugene Williams of the world today, the immigrant children at the border. Find courage from the people in Puerto Rico and the people in Tennessee. White, black, and Latino who came together and barricaded themselves against ICE and said, no, not this time, you're not getting these immigrant people that you have come for. Find the hope and the courage and getting into Baba Vakin, who was chartered away all the way through from where we are now to getting to a world without all this oppression and exploitation. Find the courage, the hope, and the determination by meeting folks in the revolution now and strategizing together to go to work on the problems of the revolution now so that we can advance to the point where we can really overthrow this system and where these commemorations will be happening not in a world where we have to draw the lines of continuation, but where we can point people to museums and tell them about how back then there used to be this land called America. There used to be this land of white supremacy and genocide and slavery, this land of male supremacy and wars for empire. And there were some fools who actually thought this thing was eternal. There were some people who actually thought this was the way things had to be. There were some people who actually thought there was nothing they could do about it. And we teach people, yes, you really have to believe one day in the past things were really that bad, and recognize the heroes who stepped forward and said no more. Thank you.
That was Noche Diaz of the Revolution Club and the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour speaking in Chicago at a commemoration of Red Summer. And we'll be reporting on a tour as it shakes Chicago up over the next few months, so don't miss any of those reports. Now we're going to hear a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's from a talk he gave in 2017, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible." He's responding to a question, how can we sustain the massive movement required to drive this regime from power? Check this out.
And this is a simple, it's not a simple question, but it's a short question. How is it possible?
That's not necessarily the same thing.
That's right. So how is it possible to maintain a movement of that scale for a long period of time?
Well, all kinds of things are possible if people understand the necessity for them. You know, you see, for example, in response to disasters of various kinds, all kinds of people swing into motion and donate all kinds of resources and things because they're so motivated to do so. When people don't the reason I spent a long time in my remarks talking about why this is necessary, what the actual situation we're dealing with and what the implications of it are, is because the key to people acting is not being tricked into something. It's not having a clever way to get them to do something. You may get people to do things, but that's not going to be sustained, and it's not going to go in a good direction. In order for people to act in the kind of way that's necessary and is being called for here, they have to understand why it's necessary. Because you are calling on people to step outside of their comfort zone, to use that phrase. You are calling on people to make sacrifices, to break with their normal routine, to break with the way they would like to hope things could be resolved, many people at least. You know, most people would hope that it wouldn't require extraordinary efforts on their part to actually, you know, move this situation in a positive direction and avert a disastrous outcome. You know, people, you know, once again, we go back to Harriet Tubman and the slaves. There's a tendency among people to stay with the horror they know rather than to risk the one they don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's something we have to struggle against. You know, that's why people have to understand what are the stakes here. It's not that we're, you know, making this up or exaggerating again in order to trick people into doing something. Study yourself, look into the reality of this. Look into what we're saying. Look into what I was talking about today. Is it true or not true? If it's true, what are the implications? What do people need to do? It's on that basis that people will act. And, you know, there have been plenty of examples of that. There are examples, you know, in the contemporary world where people did succeed in ousting, a government, you know, or forcing a government, a head of government to resign. Sometimes with good outcomes, sometimes with not, but there have been examples in places, for example, like South Korea. There have been, you know, I felt a tremendous surge of pride when William Westmoreland, I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, but he was, for a number of years, the commander of the American forces in Vietnam. And he was replaced, and he came back and ran this line out that a lot of reactionary fools run out. But it did kind of give you a sense of pride when he said, "We never lost the war in Vietnam. We lost it in Berkeley." And I felt like, not just out of narrow considerations, because I came from Berkeley, but, you know, understanding that what he meant metaphorically, we lost it because people in this country stood up against it and continued to fight against it until, you know, that merged with the resistance that the Vietnamese people were putting up and refusing to be subdued. And we were forced to finally give it up. And so, you know, that was a more protracted process than we can afford right now. We can't afford 8-10 years of this. It has to be much more telescoped. It has to be much more immediate. But the same principle applies. People became convinced that that war was just so horrific. I mean, they killed 3 million people in Vietnam, the U.S., many of them civilians, many of them little children. The My Lai massacre that many of you may know about, but everybody should know about, where they went into a village and just wiped out everybody, old people, children, everything, and then lied about it. And by the way, while I'm at it, one of their great heroes, Colin Powell, was an officer in the military at that time who was one of the main people responsible for covering up or trying to cover up what happened at My Lai. But as has been shown by people who studied this, that was not an exception. That was a pattern. That was what the U.S. military did, go into villages and just slaughter people. They dropped napalm, you know, on little children as well as other people. Napalm, which they first used, by the way, in the Korean War, is basically jellied gasoline. You know, and it when it lands on people, it just essentially sets their flesh on fire. Some of you may have seen that picture of that little girl back from, you know, the days of the Vietnam War, running down a road naked, having been subjected to a napalm attack. They used Agent Orange, which is a chemical weapon. They destroyed large parts of it. Vietnam was an agricultural country where people depended overwhelmingly on farming. They destroyed large parts of the land with these chemical weapons. You know, you see, in this, when I was talking about, you know, the generation that came of age in the 1960s and some of the great things they did, and then way far too many have become, to use that French word, récupéré, you know, recouped, brought back within the under the wing of the system. You know, a lot of those people did really heroic things. Some of them did stupid things because they became frustrated, you know, and they tried ways of fighting back that weren't going to lead to anything positive. But overwhelmingly, people did really positive things in standing up against that. And it's because they became convinced, you know, they refused to allow this to be done in their name. First of all, they recognized the horror it was, but also it was being done in their name. Just as these horrors are being committed today in our name. You know, you hear these fascists, the American people, this and that. Well, the American people is not one big blob. There are a lot of different people, you know, who have different viewpoints on things. And there's a large section of people that can't stand what's going on now. And we have to reach those people and get them to understand the necessity of what's going on. You know, the necessity of dealing with what's going on, the reality of what's going on, and the necessity of dealing with it. That's the way things can become sustained, is when people really come to see the full dimensions of what's happening and the implications of what will happen if it's allowed to go on the course, to continue on the course it's going on. There's no shortcut to getting people to do what needs to be done. Yes, we should find a way for people to do things while they're learning. We should find a way for people to be involved while they have questions, and we should discuss their questions with them. We shouldn't treat people as if they're idiots because they have questions or they don't agree with something. We should honestly discuss these things. If someone can show that all this is not really that bad, and that the implications are not all really that terrible, well, fine. You know, there's still plenty wrong in the world, but at least we don't have to do this. But let somebody show that. Let's see the argument. But the reality is, and there's plenty of evidence for to show this reality, that it really is this horrible, that it really is going to go in a very disastrous direction. I mean, I don't know what the tactics are and the differences are, but what does it mean when someone like Trump, you know, says these things about, you know, that, you know, North Korea is going to face, you know, terrible destruction like it's never been seen before? Or he gets up in the UN, of all places, and says he's going to, if they dare to do anything against us, we're going to utterly destroy them. What does it mean when he just, you know, says this weekend, there's only one course of action to deal with North Korea? You know, that's just one dimension. It's a very, you know, it is a terrible dimension. And even though there's a lot of jockeying and a lot of, you know, rhetoric being thrown around, things even on that basis can spin out of control. This is very dangerous. And that's just one dimension of the disaster that's in store. And people will move, people will act on the basis of understanding that and being one to see that. Not by being yelled at, you know. Some people deserve to be yelled at, okay? You know, but people who are, you know, these people who went to Charlottesville, you know, you're not going to reason with them, okay? You know, and certainly not in their masses. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are good-hearted, who want to see a better world but are not convinced of things. You have to look, we can't sit down and talk to them for days while everything's going on, but you have to, you know, get them moving and let's discuss things while we're moving. Let's have some, you know, the debate here. Let's dig into the reality here. That's the way anything good will be built, is if we unite with people to act on the basis of what they understand at a given time, given that it's going in a positive direction, and continue to debate and struggle about what is the bigger picture into which all this fits. And, you know, that applies to driving out the Trump-Pence regime, and for us communists, it applies to the whole thing of making revolution. I was going to say, I got diverted myself, I have to get this in, talking about the Vietnam War. See, here's the problem again. One of the chants that people, you know, the most popular chant during the anti-war demonstrations at the time of Vietnam, when LBJ, the Democratic president, was the one, you know, presiding over this slaughter in Vietnam. One of the popular chants was, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today?" For very good reason. Now you see all these liberals like Rob Reiner, who, by the way, once knew better. He wasn't always, you know, where he's at now. He once understood a lot more and spoke in better terms. Makes a movie, you know, glorifying LBJ. So, you know, there's a lot of struggle that has to go on. But those people, you see, in those days, the motion was positive. I myself, you know, was hanging around on the Berkeley campus in those days. And I saw not just one, but a number of people who came out of families who were right-wing Republicans, voted for Barry Goldwater. Now, some of you may not know about Barry Goldwater, but you can go back and find out. was you know, extremely right-wing, you know, and to the point is sort of tottering on lunacy, who was a Republican candidate for president in 1964. I knew people, you know, students at Berkeley, whose families voted for Goldwater, and they were, you know, terrific radicals within 1 year. Because they were young and they weren't, you know, they weren't tied into, you know, the idea that things could only be this way. And they weren't invested in the idea that, you have to go along with the way things are, or the way your parents told you the world is the only way that it could possibly be. You know, back in those days, here I'm going to get myself into trouble. Back in those days, we had a slogan, don't trust anybody over 30. Because, you know, the country was being run by a bunch of old fuddy-duddies who were resisting everything good and waging a war in Vietnam and so on. And, now I'm really going far afield, but Jerry Rubin, who was one of the main organizers against the Vietnam War, was one of the people who helped popularize that slogan. Then when he turned 31, he said, well, we have this slogan, don't trust anybody over 35. So we have to be careful about sliding principles here. But my main point is the main point is that people went through big changes in those times because big questions were being thrown up. And those who weren't deeply invested in, this is the best of all possible things, it couldn't possibly be any better, and anybody who says anything different ought to be forced to go to Russia or whatever, or told love it or leave it or whatever. The people who weren't invested in that were not only willing, but they felt compelled to look into these things because so many big questions were being thrown up. And people went through big changes very quickly, and that has to happen and can happen now, but it has to happen in a very telescope way because, as I said, the resistance to the Vietnam War was very important, but it built and was sustained over years and years. We don't have years and years now. So we've got to do this in a very intense and telescoped way. But the key point is people change because they're challenged, but also they're united with where they do have good instincts and good impulses, and they're challenged to look at the world as it actually is and to come to the conclusion about what needs to be done on that basis. When they see the necessity, even as they're being united with, when they see that this is what's really needed, what really needs to happen, that's when people can get involved and can sustain things.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from a talk he gave in 2017, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go, In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America. A Better World is Possible. The entire talk is available at refusefascism.org and revcom.us. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
I want to hear your thoughts, see it all, like a heat waves through the walls. You want to go out tonight, you want to